Do children suffer if they have gay parents? Should voters be able to defend laws when their states won't? How are opponents of same-sex marriage harmed by it? Some of the questions raised at the Supreme Court today as the justices took up the first of two cases regarding same-sex marriage. The first, Hollingsworth v. Perry, challenging Proposition 8, the California voter-approved ban on gay marriage. Emily Bazelon, senior editor at Slate, was in the courtroom, just came out a little while ago. Emily, first of all, just what was your sense of what the feeling was like in the courtroom?
It was electric. This is a question that the justices have never weighed in on before, and you could really feel the anticipation to hear what they were going to say.
Well, and there were questions of whether or not the defendants had even standing in the case. Charles Cooper, who's the attorney representing the backers of the California ban, we understand was just 12 words into his argument when Chief Justice John Roberts interrupted him. Why?
Because it's not clear that the defenders of Proposition 8, California's gay marriage ban, have the right to be challenging the trial court ruling striking down that ban. This is a funny case. The Attorney General of California and the governor declined to defend the constitutionality of this marriage ban. And so the question is, can this other group step in and do that?
And so you mentioned yesterday that this might happen, that there might be questions of standing. But what do you take from that?
I think the court is not clear about whether to get rid of this case for lack of standing or to strike down Proposition 8, the gay marriage ban, in a way that would just affect California or affect some states or affect all the states. Yeah. What I did not hear were 5 votes to uphold the gay marriage ban in California.
Well, let's remind people, yesterday you explained to us the different options, the different possibilities. The court might decide to simply strike the ban in California because California, before the ban, had offered gay marriage to its citizens. So that is, you know, very unique to that state. They may say you can't do that, offer something and take it back. They might strike down bans on gay marriage anywhere. They might question whether a state can have civil unions, as California does, almost marriage in everything but name, according to some of the justices, which opens up a whole can of worms about states that have gay civil unions. So from what you were hearing, you know, tell us again what you think you might have heard in today's arguments.
Well, there were different justices drawn to the various options. You could hear Justice Breyer uncomfortable with the idea that the 8 states that have civil unions and not marriage would be somehow penalized for making some progress toward gay marriage, but not going all the way. Then you heard various justices, Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kennedy, wondering about standing and even whether the case should have been granted at all. Kennedy seemed to question at one point what the case was doing before the court.
Well, and get to some of the more pointed exchanges. We're going to take this up again later in the program, but you know, what were some of the exchanges that stood out to you?
The most moving moment, I think, came from Justice Kennedy. He said that he recognized the newness of same-sex marriage and of the sociological research about its effects. But then he said, what about the voices of the children? And he was talking about the children of same-sex couples whose parents cannot get married right now. And he seemed genuinely worried about their predicament, and it injected a real note of emotion into the proceedings.
40,000 children, according to some of the blog posts we've seen. But there were also, it seems like off of that, there were exchanges about who can have children. It got into this very nutty thing, pulling Charles Cooper, again, representing the backers of the ban on gay marriage, into just who can have children, 55-year-olds. Tell us about that.
Yes, you're right. Justice Kagan did an artful job of saying, well, what if you have 2 people who are married who are above the age of 55? It seems like your main argument, Mr. Cooper, from your briefs, is that marriage is about procreation. That's what it comes down to, the ability to procreate. So what do we do about infertile couples or older people? And honestly, I did not think that Charles Cooper had a clear and good answer to that question.
Well, because from our understanding, he wants to argue that this is a case less about homosexuality or gayness, but states' rights.
Right. Although he wasn't sticking to that, he made a few points about leaving this to the voters, the idea that it is premature for the Supreme Court to cut off what he called the anguish debate over gay marriage that's taking place across the country. And so he was sticking very much with this idea that the will of the voters of California should be respected and that they had not made an irrational decision by deciding to ban gay marriage.
Slate's Emily Bazelon reporting on the Supreme Court today. We'll have more later. Emily, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
We have more on our top story now. Today's Supreme Court arguments over California's Proposition 8, the 2008 ballot initiative that banned gay marriage in that state after it had been legalized and several thousand couples had already been married. Emily Bazelon of Slate told us earlier it was electric in the courtroom today. Let's pick up with Jonathan Turley, a George Washington University law professor. Jonathan, welcome as always.
Thank you.
And Greg Storr, who covers the Supreme Court for Bloomberg News. Greg, you were also in the court today. Do you agree? Electric?
Very much so. It was a rapid-fire argument. Fascinating. Some great moments of drama and some great moments of humor.
Well, we want to get to both. But Emily also said that there was a moment that told her that the court might not even decide on this, that they were asking about whether or not the defendants of Proposition 8 even had standing in the courtroom. Your sense of that?
Right. It's there's two different ways the court could basically back out of the case. One is that, and the other one is what Justice Anthony Kennedy raised, which is basically he said, I'm not sure we should have agreed to hear this case at all. He didn't necessarily buy the argument that the defenders of Proposition 8 didn't have standing, but he seemed very reluctant to make what is clearly going to be a very big decision when this whole debate is really still at an early stage.
And Jonathan Turley, this is not a surprise. You know, Kennedy had made these comments before. Even one of the more liberal justices, Ginsburg, had referred to Roe v. Wade as maybe a court going too fast ahead of the population in making a decision that turned out to be too polarizing. So are you, what is your sense after hearing what's been said today of what they might do?
Well, actually, for weeks I've been cautioning folks that are, I thought, getting a little ahead of the reality in the case. People have been talking about the possibility of a sweeping recognition of equal rights for same-sex couples and homosexuals generally, something that I would certainly support. But I've always thought that was pretty doubtful. The more likely thing would be that the court would find an incremental step. This is a very incrementalist court, even when it's not so polarized. It's a court that tries to defer to the political process, to social change. They don't like to lead those changes. Now, they've done it on historic moments like Brown v. Board of Education, Roe v. Wade, but those also came at a price for the court institutionally. You know, they became the lightning rod. They were viewed as forcing the decision on the country. And what I do think I come away from the oral argument a little bit surprised at was how uncertain Kennedy was in some respects with regard to gay rights. You know, Kennedy, who's been generally viewed as supportive, talked about how it's not clear how this trend, as he called it, is going to turn out. He said it might be magnificent or it might go over a cliff. And it was it showed that Kennedy is still wrestling with this question in a fundamental way. You also saw Roberts, who expressed a great deal of almost irritation at being forced to deal with this question at this time. And many of the justices just said this is a new issue for them, which I think would surprise many folks, because I think most of us look at this and say, yeah, it's really not that new.
Well, Greg, didn't one of the justices say at one point, gay marriage is as new as cell phones and the internet?
Yes, I think that was Justice Alito who said that. And there's certainly one argument you heard from the more conservative justices was that this is such a new debate, and we need to let this percolate a little bit more. Justice Alito with the cell phone comment. There was clearly a reluctance among them to declare a nationwide right to gay marriage or even a California-specific right.
Well, and yet, as we've been hearing, you know, polls have shifted so much that there are those who argue, well, wait a second, the court is not out ahead of popular thinking. They're actually behind it. But let's talk about some more of the exchanges that you heard today, Greg. I'm thinking of one where Antonin Scalia asked Ted Olson, who's representing the two couples who are looking to get rid of the ban, you know, when did it actually become unconstitutional to bar gays and lesbians from marrying? Was it 1791, 1868? Ted Olson responded with an answer that reminds a lot of people of why they think that this issue should be at the Supreme Court.
Yeah, that was a fabulous exchange, and at one point they were basically talking over one another. His answer was, well, when did it become unconstitutional? He answered with a question, which Justice Scalia didn't like, and the question was, well, when did it become unconstitutional to ban interracial marriages, which the Supreme Court said states had to allow back in 1967? And then Justice Scalia responded. First, he said, don't answer my question with a question. And then he said, well, in that case, I know that it became unconstitutional when we enacted the 14th Amendment after the Civil War. And then there was some more back and forth there. But it was and Ted Olson basically said, if I recall correctly, that, look, you do this all the time. You declare a right without necessarily trying to say that the right came into fruition at a particular point in time.
Jonathan Turley, what else jumped out at you?
Well, first of all, I thought Scalia's question was a silly one in some respects. I mean, the fact is that the court is presented with the recognition of a right, and it seems odd for Scalia, who was in the majority on the Second Amendment Heller case, saying that this is an individual right. He gave birth to a new right that many people didn't recognize before, and he didn't ask the same questions. What stood out for me also in terms of the slight hypocrisy side is Alito, who is defending the standing of those supporting Proposition 8. Alito just wrote an opinion in the case called Clapper that eradicated standing for civil liberties groups, lawyers, journalists who were trying to challenge unlawful surveillance and secret surveillance. And he would not accept any argument that they had standing, and yet he became the big defender of standing for the group that's trying to fight against same-sex marriage. And I thought that was sort of a hypocrisy light went off in my mind. I think that ultimately the takeaway from today is what many of us have felt for a while, which is this court's not ready. And the question is whether Kennedy can prevail on his colleagues to basically do a do-over and say, we just don't have the votes, we're not going to speak with one mind. And it's not clear why they thought they'd speak with one mind when they accepted it. But, you know, Earl Warren had a very strong rule with regard to cases like this. He wasn't afraid to hand down a major change in the constitutional law, but he wanted the court to speak with either one voice or with a supermajority on questions like this. They clearly don't have it.
No.
That
became clear. Jonathan Turley, George Washington University law professor, and we've also been speaking with Greg Storr, who covers the Supreme Court for Bloomberg News. We will post the audio from the court today. We'll post a link to it when it becomes available and everyone can hear for themselves. But meanwhile, Jonathan, Greg, thanks so much.
Thank you.
A pleasure.
On to tomorrow's case. Back in a minute here and now.